Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello again, everybody. Last week, when I got back from China, we did a few segments on the nature of China's government and economy. We'll do two segments this week on its foreign policy, specifically on whether China and its neighbors or China and the U.S. might wind up at war as China rises as a world power and as the U.S. presumably declines. With me for the first of these conversations is Elizabeth Economy, Director of Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Dr. Economy, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks very much, Brian.
So when I was in China, I heard about a widespread perception that the Obama administration is trying to encircle China militarily by holding military exercises with Vietnam, of all countries, in the South China Sea recently, and by deploying Marines to Australia. How do you see the U.S. show of muscle in China's front yards?
I think it's important to remember in many respects, it was China's actions back in 2009 and 2010 that provoked consternation in the region that in fact, caused many countries in the region to invite the United States to assert a more sort of a stronger presence in Asia. The Chinese conveniently forget that they undertook some pretty tough rhetoric, calling the region South China Sea, you know, Chinese core interests, that they started pushing their boats, fishing boats and patrol boats further and further out, and that in fact is what led to the opportunity in many respects for the United States to pivot or to rebalance, as we're now calling it, in Asia.
To what end was China doing that, and who does it threaten how?
Well, I think that, in fact, it was part of a broader assertion of Chinese foreign policy as a result, in many respects, of the sense within Beijing that the United States was in decline. You know, this was around 2008, 2009, there was a widespread feeling among many in the Chinese leadership, both in the security and in the financial sectors, that the United States had now begun the inevitable process of, you know, moving from hegemon to part of a multipolar world and really losing a lot of its sort of great power status. So this, you know, provided, I think,
but that's so abstract, isn't it?
It's not really abstract. I mean, I think for those who wanted China to sort of move past what had been Deng Xiaoping's mantra of hide brightness, cherish obscurity, just focus on Chinese domestic politics and wait our time. We're not a great power. We're a middling power. We're a developing country. This kind of decline of the U.S. really offered an opportunity for those within Beijing to say, we can do more and the time is now.
Give us that Deng Xiaoping slogan again. I heard that when I was there, too, and I think people will find it really interesting. Hide brightness, cherish obscurity.
Right. It's part of a much longer sort of 24-character idiom, but that's the essence of it. And what it really means is just, you know, we need to focus, or the way it's been adapted in the current Chinese context is really we need to focus on the home front, you know, develop our economy. We want a peaceful international situation so that we can focus in on what we need to get done at home. But, you know, again, 2009 or so, you had, you know, one of China's central bankers, Zhou Xiaochuan, saying we should maybe move away from the dollar as the world's reserve currency. You had PLA Navy say we're moving from a near seas to a far coastal defense, which basically means we're going to be pushing out our ships and our air force far beyond what had been sort of our territorial waters. We want to protect access, to our resources that we're bringing from Africa and Latin America and other parts.
Is that a bad thing? Is that an aggressive thing?
It's all within their right to say, you know, everything. I think if had it not been coupled with, you know, cutting the cables for Vietnamese, ships and doing other sort of more menacing activities, you know, ramming a Japanese Coast Guard boat or this kind of thing, I think then people would have understood it and it wouldn't have provoked the same kind of reaction within the region. But again, it was also coupled with a much more sort of military real action, I think, is really what made everybody get so worried.
What was that cutting cables incident?
That was with Vietnam and with one of their oil exploration efforts, because the Chinese consider that to be taking place within Chinese territorial waters.
And what? There was a Vietnamese boat of some kind, and what did they do?
And they had cables. They had cables extending out, and the Chinese came and cut them. And they've actually just done that again in the past 2 months or so. So there have been a series of provocations from the Chinese Navy and from Chinese fishing boats that have caused many countries in the region, the Philippines, Vietnam, Japan in particular, to become concerned. And beyond that, frankly, we've just had this issue with the passport, China issuing a passport that basically presents a map of all of the disputed territories, including those with India, as Chinese territory. And so this has set up off another round of angst within the region and another round of sort of reciprocal action by a number of these countries, printing up their own visa forms with their own maps of disputed territory. So it's this kind of activity, I think, that makes people in the region feel as though this rise of China is not going to be peaceful. And that era of win-win diplomacy that they kept talking about 5 or 6 years ago really is over.
Another example that I heard about is, short of invading another country, China needing more water than it has, which is well known, and diverting rivers that deprive neighboring countries of water that they have been using in the past. Are you familiar with that?
Sure. I think there are sort of two different or three really different cases. I think the first is, the Mekong River. There it's not really a diversion of the water, but it's having many, many dams and hydropower plants along the Mekong, and thereby controlling the water that the downstream countries like Vietnam and Cambodia can access. And that's been a source of problems for well over a decade. A second one is with regard to India. And here, this is what's called the Yarlung Tsangpo coming out of China, turns into the Brahmaputra in India. And here the Chinese denied that they were going to do anything for a long time until the Indians actually had satellite pictures that showed them constructing a dam. And the Chinese then said, we're just building a dam. We're not diverting anything, so don't worry about it. But there's still, again, a lot of consternation in India because they don't trust the Chinese. And why should they? Because the Chinese had been denying that they were doing anything for years. And then the third issue, I think, has to do with Kazakhstan. And here, too, the Chinese have been talking about diverting, have been damming river that flows into Kazakhstan. But interestingly enough, this is the one case where the Chinese actually have sat down to negotiate with the Kazakhs. There was some threat of retaliatory action in Kazakhstan. It may be because the Chinese are interested in the natural gas coming from Kazakhstan that the Kazakhs actually have a little leverage. But there are several different cases where China, which controls a lot of the headwaters in Tibetan Qinghai Plateau, where they are sort of mucking about and causing, again, worries in the region. And it should, I think, probably be noted that China is one of only three countries in the United Nations that doesn't recognize the right of shared water resources, which means that basically when you do have the kind of power that China has with regard to water resources, that you sit down and negotiate with downstream countries and negotiate access.
I think California and Colorado have a similar problem. But do you see that beyond China? Do you see that as a coming area of conflict in the 20th century? Water rights, nation to nation? Who owns water?
I think certainly it's already been a significant issue, and it's only going to be exacerbated, I think, as climate change begins to cause more and more disruptions. And, in China alone, they have watched their lakes and their rivers simply dry up. And watching the glaciers melt, I think this is going to be a very serious issue moving forward.
By the way, on Wednesday, we'll do a separate segment specifically on the disputed islands that China and Japan both claim. You referred to that a minute ago indirectly, and how a U.S.-Japan military treaty could draw the U.S. into a shooting war if things develop badly, and maybe even soon. So we'll explore that in depth with another guest on Wednesday. But how concerned are you about that scenario?
Well, I think there's reason to be concerned, but I'm not overly concerned. And the reason is that I think among the United States, China, and Japan, these are three reasonably mature and developed, governance bodies. I think our governments are all committed to maintaining a degree of stability in the relationship. Nobody wants to see the relationship spiral down out of control. You could see that when the Chinese demonstrations, the anti-Japanese demonstrations were taking place and, they ran their course and then the Chinese government just said, okay, that's it, all done. You know, no more trashing Japanese companies and beating people senseless for owning Japanese cars. So I think they may take it right up to the brink. But my feeling is that in the end, calmer heads will prevail. And even if some shots were fired across between Japan and China, you would very quickly find them at the negotiating table.
My guest on WNYC is Elizabeth Economy from the Council on Foreign Relations and Foreign Affairs magazine. She is an expert on China and China's relations with the U.S. And in an article in Foreign Affairs called The Game Changer, you wrote that China is becoming more assertive in its foreign policy and that it doesn't only want to assume a greater stake in international organizations, it wants to remake the rules of the game. What rules of the game?
Well, I think we've seen in the past few years a couple of instances where what is sort of the status quo in terms of global governance, doesn't really work either to China's favor or really sort of correspond to the way that China conducts its foreign policy. So, for example, within the International Monetary Fund, there is, an annual review of currency practices, as well as there are requirements for transparency in lending. And these are both things that China does not support. And as China's role and its stake in the IMF grows, I think we can expect that China will try to push its own interests more aggressively and have these kinds of regulations reformed or changed. I think we see certainly on the economic front, in terms of Chinese lending practices and overseas investment that, again, this lack of transparency is problematic for a number of OECD countries, including the United States. It's very difficult to compete in terms of export financing with the way that China does business. Recently, we've had this travail over accounting practices, right? And mm-hmm. China claiming sovereignty and not being interested in having the SEC or other regulatory bodies inspect the work documents of accounting firms in China, even if they're U.S. Subsidiaries of accounting firms, and saying that these are secret documents, but then not having other exchanges, stock exchanges, being able to tell whether or not fraud is being perpetrated by some of these Chinese companies. So I think that there are a lot of different ways, frankly, and they can seem small, but in many respects they will add up simply because China is such a large, significant economic player and increasingly, sort of player on the world stage in many other areas.
So those are some of the issues. And you wrote an article last week in the Boao Review, if that's how you pronounce it, in which you challenged the notion that Chinese versus American power on the world stage is a zero-sum game. And you call for greater coexistence between China and the United States by removing the most contentious issues from the center of China-U.S. relations. What issues are those?
Well, I think the point that I was trying to make in the piece was really, sort of a two-pronged strategy. One was taking something like the currency issue that has arisen, every year, courtesy of Congress, and sort of the threat that we're going to place tariffs on Chinese exports to the United States if they continue to intervene in their currency. Sort of take that off the table and actually look and approach that kind of issue in a multilateral context, because I think perhaps the most important point that I was trying to make in the piece was really that the types of issues that the United States confronts with China are not, 99% of the time unique to the U.S.-China relationship. And in fact, these issues are shared by many other countries. and that sort of the United States ends up being front and center, and these issues end up becoming caught in a kind of just the bilateral context and raising the tension between the two countries, when in fact we ought to sort of lower the tension by working with other countries to sort of work with China and to pressure China to understand that these are not simply norms that the United States is attempting to enforce with regard to China, but that mm-hmm. these are norms that are upheld and supported by many other countries in the international arena.
Two other things real quick before you go. I was asking people in China if their country has any values or international standards of behavior that it promotes in its foreign policy. Like the U.S. tries to stand for democracy, even though we're horribly inconsistent at it. I couldn't find any such values or standards or norms. Was I missing something?
Well, I think that the Chinese would say that, in fact, they do have values that others should consider, such as, you know, sovereignty and peaceful coexistence. And, you know, they have their five principles of peaceful coexistence that they've been talking about for, you know, almost 60 years now. And I think that these are the values that the Chinese sort of that they believe guide their own foreign policy. They are not as sort of expansionist in their ideology as the United States is, but certainly there have been some, you know, articles written and some quiet talk among experts in China that, in fact, the world would be a better place if other countries began to consider the way that China practices its foreign policy and didn't simply look to emulate the United States.
What would they be? Or maybe give us another one. I mean, when they talk about sovereignty, I tend to think that that's, you know, that means don't interfere with our human rights violations. Does it mean something something more than that? Did you hear the question? Did we lose Dr. Economy?
Hello?
Can you hear me? Did we lose you? I think she can't hear me. So I think if she can't hear me, there's only one thing to do, and that is take a break, and we'll either come and finish up this segment with a final question or two, or we will move on to our next conversation, which is going to be very interesting, and that has to do with think tanks, because with Jim DeMint, a committed ideologue taking over the Heritage Foundation, we will ask, does anyone at a think tank actually think? And this is not just about Heritage. This is, do any of the think tanks just bring the cover of research to partisan warfare, or do they actually try to make anybody think? Stay with us.